Well, Ross is.
Well,
that's
he
a way of making you feel like you're the only actor in the world.
When you go fishing, man, you know.
I got hooked. I got hooked.
Hello, everyone. Hola, mis amigos. You're listening to Oh My God, Hi, Hijo de Dios, Hola. With me, George Lopez, porque sabes que, let's do the show, porque está calante, tengo la dry cleaner ahí, my kid fell, se pegó la cabeza, I gotta go get some Neosporin Paul.
You know who George is?
Oh, I'm sure he's around here somewhere.
What's his name?
George Lopez.
George Lopez.
Oh my God.
OMG.
OMG. Hi.
Oh my God, hi.
You think if they made a flute out of skin that it would play? A real flute.
I think they can make
not the one from Puff and Stuff. Not the one that talks. Another one.
I think they can make that work.
Do you know that every time I listen to the Puff and Stuff song, would I play it?
Oh.
It make me start crying.
Well, throws you back there.
That and Brian's song. I think me and you, the poster for the show should be Brian's song. Like, I'll be Gale Sayers and you be James Conney.
Right. And then ding, the song ding, plays and we start crying.
Ding, 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 ding.
Oh.
Just like in The Hulk when he left town. And they used to play that sad song. Every time he went to a town, like my uncle, he'd get fucked up. Like my uncle would go to Silmar with a fucking bleeding eye. And I'd say, where were you? And he would say, fuck Silmar. As if the whole town had kicked his ass. Hey, only my uncle could come back with a fucking torn mouth. And he'd be like, fuck Fedco. You know, like if the owner of Fedco kicked him in his face.
His clothes were all torn.
Even at Gemco, which everybody had a beautiful experience with, he didn't.
Who didn't have a beautiful experience at Gemco? That was one of my favorite places in the world.
I used to work at Fedco, and you know, I'm a little bit removed. And there was this girl that was fucking hot, man.
At Fedco, worked there. Who
girl,
worked there?
You know, fucking Theta out there, beautiful fucking knobs, like trying to think KSJ. Fucking radio knobs. Yeah, I think it even had numbers on her nipples.
And
one
what happened?
One said MHS megahertz, and the other one said kg kilograms.
Did you make a move?
With a couple of pelos. You ever seen that nipple that had hairs around it?
Yeah, those are...
Under the sea.
Those are shocking. When you find those are a little shocking. Hey, we got a little electrical problem here.
If you touch them both, you get a spark merrier.
It'll start your engine.
You know, I never thought I would get remarried, and then some girl told me one time, I don't have a gag reflex, and I got on one knee, and I said, with this ring, IV wed, cabrón. All right, what's this show going to be about today?
It's going to be a faith-based show.
Good, because I have faith that by the time I finish this one, I'm going to be all about myself.
Okay.
Hey, what's that name of that girl that was keeps calling? Whore face? Not whore face, Theo. Whore something.
Horvath.
Jeremy, come on, Rimmer.
We are, today's going to be a face
show. If I saw my uncle in the park a month after, I would say, what are you doing, Theo? He goes, what are you doing? I'm doing practicing that name, Horvath.
All on his park.
What's today?
Today is, we are with Edward James
Olmos.
Are
you a religious individual or are you not? Would you grow up Catholic?
I did grow up Catholic. My mother was a very strict Catholic. My father switched from Methodist to Catholic to marry my mother. Fernando's.
Fucking dancing, huh?
Yeah. He switched over.
He was doing the fucking jitterbug right there.
Yeah, right. He was great at the reception. Unfortunately, he didn't
start
dancing.
What's your dad's waist? 24? Nobody has
My dad is a very thin waist.
Yeah.
I'm about a 32.
He looked like
you do it
from Wild Wild West. The little guy?
The little
James
dude.
Conrad.
Yeah, James Conrad.
Or the little midget.
He was a little
can't
guy.
Can't say midget.
Mr.
The little dwarf.
What was his character?
Ananito.
What was Conrad's character name? You know, was it Mr. Jones?
James West.
James West. And he said, Mr. West, the little guy.
Not like my character, Captain James T. Goodass. It should be my alias.
So we'll be at a golf course and there'll be a guy with really tight pants on. And he's showing his crack through there. And he's a ladies and gentlemen, Captain James T. Goodass.
I would say, check out all the Captain James T. Goodass.
Yeah, I never escape. But anyways, Edward James Olmos, excuse me, and Kathleen Quinlan on the show today. Amazing actors. And you acted
from Walking with Her.
Walking with Her, co-starring George Lopez in this movie. So it's going to be quite a show to actually be able to talk to them about working with you.
You know, if you think about faith and you think about... You know, even just mentioning that, like right now when I think about faith, in San Fernando, when I was growing up in San Fernando, California, and I would go to the Comedy Store in Westwood. This is called, this is like June of 1979. And I wasn't very religious. My grandmother was, and my grandfather was not biological, I keep saying. And he would pray in the room. Like, I would walk by, he'd be praying by the side of the bed, and he wouldn't go to church. And he would make me and my grandmother go, and I would say, how come you're not going? He goes, because I fucking pray here, and it goes straight up. You, I don't know what the fuck you're doing. You need to go to the main office. Mine, I could do them here.
Yeah.
But you need to go talk to the personnel department.
He had a direct line. Yeah.
So, I don't think I ever told this story. So, as an 18-year-old young man, just out of high school, on Monday around 2 or 3 in the afternoon, I would go to St. Ferdinand's Church in San Fernando. And I would sit toward the back of the church. There was nobody in there, maybe one lady or two, and I would get on my knees and I would pray that I would do well that night and that I would not be afraid to go up because you didn't know when you signed up, mm-hmm. and that somehow God would bless me.
Wow.
And I did it every time. So once I do something once, like I have to do it and keep doing it. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of that summer, I go there and I'm on my knees and I'm praying. And I look down at the book and there's a paper sticking out of the book. And the paper pretty much says, if you believe in what you believe, that everything that you imagine can be accomplished.
Wow.
A written paper. Oh. Not part of the books. It was sticking out of the book. And I don't know where it came from. I don't know who wrote it, or I don't know how it got there. But when I sat in that pew and I looked down, that paper was there.
That is crazy.
Palma, you know who wrote it? I wrote it. I thought you didn't read the back. That said, fucking put it in your pee hole.
God said that. So.
But unbelievably to me, like I looked at it as an endorsement because I would have never met, you know, going there, I went from, it didn't make me better or didn't make me worse, but somehow it just gave me, I'm not sure what it gave me. It
gave you the strength and confidence to get up there,
it's
right?
It's hard, man. Yeah. Like, I was, you know, grew up in San Fernando, a little Chicano kid, like just 18. Nobody was going to the Comedy Store.
Yeah.
You know, and to go and do that and then to have the balls to go up there when I was shy and couldn't even talk to anybody.
Yeah, crazy.
I was shy. I couldn't talk about it. If you leave me in the room with a magazine, a lot of my, even though Mexican magazine, a lot of my that would have all the car accidents in Mexico and in the middle I had a centerfold, I would fire off. There'd be a fucking 3-alarm fire right there in a hotel, people jumping out of the windows, and then in the middle they had a girl with tassels right there. I'd knock a wing.
No matter what the problem.
Right.
So did that was that a ritual of yours for a long, long time then? Obviously. Was it? I mean, you did that for how long?
Okay. Yes. And then the day that we went to go pitch Stu Bloomberg at ABC for my first show, me and Bruce and Sandra and everybody, I went to Freddie Prinze's grave at Forest Lawn. And the meeting was at like 2, I went there like 10:30. And I don't know why I went there. You know, I'd stolen the headstone years before.
And decades before
79,
that.
At least 24, 25 years earlier. But I went and I said that all I needed was the opportunity. Like, I don't know why I went there. It's like, why? You could just go to a fire hydrant. It means the same thing. But to me, it meant something to go there. And that wasn't even my church, St. Ferdinand's. I used to go to Santa Rosa. That's another one. Wow. And then across the street, the bakery is the bakery that we use for Chingon Bakery.
Chingon Bakery, yeah.
Right there. Across the street from St. Ferdinand's.
Yeah.
So I go there and I say, you know, I mean, I'm so close, but I'm not there yet. Going to ABC at 2:00. I go to Freddie Prinze's grave. I'm like, I just want a chance. We go there, me, Bruce, Robert, Sandra Bullock comes in. She's dressed incredibly, almost like Well, I remember when she came out of the elevator, she turned the corner like in Miss Congeniality when she comes out of the airport, yeah. airplane hangar, like that. I'm like, whoa. Ooh. You know, like Sandra was all business. When we go to Stu Brumberg's office, I'm sitting on the couch and we're looking across his desk and he's sitting on the other side of the couch. So it's us here, chair there, he's there. And Stu Bloomberg says, it's kind of dark in here, isn't it? Let me go open the window. And he opens the window and ABC is across the freeway, the 134 freeway, from Forest Lawn. So Stu Bloomberg gets up, hits a button, and the curtains open.
Oh, my God.
And from where I'm sitting, I can see where Freddie Prinze is buried
through the
window at ABC.
Wow.
And, you know, he bought the show, and we went forward. But why would he open the window?
Right. And you recognize it right away going, oh,
the
yeah.
minute I was sitting there, and he opened it, and the blinds opened like this, and I could see through there, and I thought, I was just there. 4 hours ago, literally begging for an opportunity to who? I don't know.
Wow.
And then it happens.
Hmm. Do you still?
And then I burn myself in a kitchen fire. No, kidding. No, I
didn't. Do you still find yourself doing that though? Is that like the go-to? The move?
No.
No?
You know, I don't. You know, and it's interesting because, you know, of all the things that have happened, None you take for granted. Like, you know, I was on one of them in HBO. You do like four of those and you do everything. But I wouldn't say that I'm more or less of a believer because I'm the Buddhist principles, but also to not do people harm. Like before, I would always do people harm. I always think awful things of people. But I'm not that person anymore. But I was when I was growing up.
But I mean,
when somebody would fucking die, I'd be like, finally. I'm the only person that fucking yelled out, finally. My mom died, finally, because my grandmother would yell that. I remember I wanted to see my grandmother one time, and she was in the Sierra Memorial Hospital right there up in Lakeview Terrace, and there was a lady that kept yelling, God, take me. My grandmother was like, that fucking lady's talking that all night. And the next day she was gone. I said, what happened? And my grandmother was, thank God he took her. She died overnight.
Oh my God!
But that was oh, I became a younger version of my grandmother.
Man, how about that?
Well, on the show today. Can we stop all this fucking? By the way, the Alcohol Council has not.
Oh man,
given me the. I need to stamp these cans.
I mean, lethal. They're serious.
You know how fucking bad this beer is. This bottle's upside down on the thing.
I'm gonna get that tattoo. So when you did this, oh my gosh, let me start over. When you filmed this movie with Edward James Olmos and Catherine Quinlan,
it was the biggest part that I had ever that I had ever done.
but in knowing it was a faith-based movie, did that make you feel like you more comfortable, less comfortable, same amount of comfortableness on set? Did you think
I'm going to say that, I'm not a trained actor per se, but I look at your life as experiences.
Mm-hmm.
You know, part of that movie was very emotional where you can cry on camera. There's a couple movies that I've done where you had to cry on cue. Not a lot of, I worked with an actress one time and she went into the closet and they put some like onion water drops in her eyes and he starts crying.
Faked it.
I was able to cry without the use of that.
Mm.
A lot of times in movies, because of my background, I would just think of something that happened to me and it would make me start crying.
Mm.
Like the day I got married. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Okay, that's the joke. That's a joke sequence that goes on. Well, can you share with everybody what it was when you were crying, when you cried in this movie?
Motherfucker, listen.
What you're thinking?
Just because everything that goes through you, tell everybody. Can we just keep some secrets about this movie?
Yeah,
then why see a movie if I'm gonna tell them the whole plot?
I'm just thinking there is a scene you just shared with everybody that you cried.
What about if somebody saw Deep Throat? I already tells you that the lady's gonna probably take it all the way down to the pelos, eh? But are you gonna be the one that's gonna break our hearts and tell us that her clitoris is in her throat? I hope not.
Man, that'd be cool.
Let's let John Leslie be the judge of that. God rest his soul. A lot of pornos have died, eh?
Yeah, there's a lot there's of pornos a whole thing right there.
¿Cómo no, Teo? My other son, my uncle, was like, what's up, Teo? I'm just thinking about all the pornos I did. El John, ¿cómo se llama? John Home. ¿Cómo se llama? John Home. El otro que tenía el Winnie hasta allá. And that was the other one your tía was saying that she went to high school with John Home, but she did it. And then La Lovelace, la cabrona que, that she could, whenever she chupó la verga, a bell would ring somewhere in the movie. In Philadelphia, so, the Liberty Bell. She took it all the way down. Como,
hasta los
pelos,
animal.
Hasta los pelos, and the Liberty Bell would ring. It had a ring since 1776.
God.
And who else? Annette Jurgensen. That's not a name.
Jurgensen. Jurgensen.
Annette the lotion Jurgensen.
Girl. Oh, that's good. Okay. Outstanding. My thing was, was there something, not to give away the movie, but something you thought of that made you emotional?
You know, this time it was the time that was very emotional. It was just out of the interaction with Mr. Olmos.
How about that? That's impressive.
No, I didn't need to remember something bad to do it. It was just because of, and really maybe for the first time, when you're so engulfed in a character that I didn't expect that to happen. It wasn't written for it to happen.
Wow.
But I think just out of my respect and my admiration for him.
Right. And he didn't expect it either, though. He was thrown a little bit. Not thrown, but he was somewhat surprised by it. Yeah. It was impressive.
He told me, if there's another riot, can we go out there and sweep the streets? I said, fuck you.
And there you go.
Remember in the riots in LA, he was out there sweeping the streets?
Yeah, I do. That's an iconic moment. Him doing that? I don't mean to be laughing. Enough of us two. Let's get on with fucking Kathleen Quinlan and Edward J. Osmo. Okay, let me try it again. Take two. Fantastic, George. Let's get on with Edward J. Osmo.
Do the fucking words.
Okay. Kathleen Quinlan and Edward J. Osmo are waiting in the wings. Okay. All right. Hey, we shouldn't drink before that.
I'll tell you, man. I know we shouldn't drink before. They're not waiting in the wings, motherfucker. They're at their house. They're at the wings. They're at the fucking wings. They're at fucking Burbank.
Brought to you by Zoom. Today is Kathleen Quinlan and Edward J. Zomas.
Remember, this show is brought to you by the Horvath University.
Horvath. As your uncle called
it. Nature's candy.
As Theo says, horror face.
Shmegma. Remember, Theo, nature's candy. That's what my Theo told me. Shmegma was nature's candy.
All right. And on with the interview.
Who's doing the intros, Brian? Brian, you prepared?
I am prepared. I believe so. I think so.
Oh shit!
Hi, right. I'm ready to go.
I can't see your face, Brian. You're not lit.
Yeah. Really? It's man.
Sorry.
That's okay. I'm
you know what? You might be all right.
It'd be better that I'm shaded.
Better in the dark. Can I be in the dark?
Yeah. You know, I'm not. I never consider myself truly attractive, but Brian.
Wait. Can you tell who it is now?
That nose,
okay, all right, thank you.
That nose is simply decorations. He can't breathe out of it. It doesn't work.
Yeah,
it's really just decorative.
This is why I cannot ever enter the witness protection program anywhere, because I'll be found out in a second.
Hey, tell him that time you were at Disneyland with that girl. Check this out.
I went to Disneyland and I'm with a girl, and she's my dream girl. She went out with me. I could not believe that she was with me. And we're standing in one of those super 3-hour long lines in Disneyland that snakes around. And there's probably a 3-year-old in front of me in the arms of his father. And he looks at me and he goes, wow, you got a nose like a witch. And everybody heard it and they started laughing. So I still had 3 more hours to wait in line. So every time they passed me, they laughed at me for 3 hours straight because I had a nose exactly like a witch. And my girl, my little girl, you know, my girlfriend was just, she joined in with them and started laughing with them. So it made things even better. Greatest night of my life.
Uh-huh. Three old kid in his arms of his father. That guy's got a nose like a witch.
And the whole place blew up. They all started laughing. Okay. That's all right. Character. Built a lot of character that
night. Right. That's right.
But thank you for being here. My gosh, what an honor to have you on the podcast. And George, I don't know if you want to introduce your friends or would you like me to throw my homage to them?
I want you to do it.
Okay. Well, we have two Academy Award nominated actors in the house today. We'll start with Miss Quinlan. She's in some of my favorite movies, and I don't know if you guys even American Graffiti, Lifeguard, Apollo 13, unbelievable Academy nominated actress Kathleen Quinlan. Thank you so much for being here. And we have also.
That's all she's done is five movies and all this.
No,
all
she's, she's done a gajillion movies, but those are my personal favorites. Lifeguard being my favorite, but she has been nominated for an Academy Award, and she is an amazing actress. Over, I don't want to say how many decades, but five decades of work. Amazing actress, and we also have Mr. Olmos, Golden Globe winner, Academy Award nominee, and been in starred in Miami Vice, American Me.
Only Brian could make you feel inferior when he's reading off your accomplishments. I don't know how the fuck I don't know how somebody has the gift of reading somebody's accomplishments, and when he's done, you feel like, what? I'm a failure.
Right. When us white people meet at the Eagles Club, we all talk about this, and this is what we learn. But Miami Vice, American Me, Stand and Deliver, Blade Runner, Mayans, as well as the upcoming Walking with Herb, of course, Mr. Edward James Olmos. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Honored.
Thank you.
Very
thank
honored.
You.
To have you here. And Mr. George Lopez is on his
Kathleen,
own.
I know what Eddie was doing when he was young, and I think he aspired to be an actor. I don't think that you aspire to be an actress. You have, I think when we talk, one of those stories that you think, you know, somebody's at Schwab's or somebody somewhere and they say, you know, have you ever considered doing this? And you were doing something completely different. Would you want to share that with us?
If I can remember, yes. no, I was poking around trying to do all sorts of things. I thought I was studying to be a marine biologist, and
oh wow.
But then I found out that I couldn't finish the courses at the college I was at, and they said, "Oh, go to San Francisco State." I said, "I can't afford to go to San Francisco State. How am I going to do that?" And I didn't know there was such a thing as a scholarship. So I was doing a lot of sports, gymnastics, and 5-meter diving. And somebody said there was an audition for American Graffiti. And I took drama classes, but I didn't think you could make a living at it. I was really looking to make a living. And so somebody picked me out of all the people studying for my scuba diving license, and somebody picked me out in the hallway and asked me to come in this room with these guys, you know, George Lucas and Gino Havens and Steven Spielberg, and I read a little thing, and they said, "Well, come and do this part." They said, "Okay, well, I'm a live-in babysitter all summer on Catalina Island, but I'll come back when you're ready."
Wow.
I thought, wow, maybe I can get paid to do this. You never know.
But you know, American Graffiti became kind of like the definitive movie of a person's youth.
Mm-hmm.
Did it feel like that when they were doing it? No.
No, it felt like the circus came to town. You know, I was living up in Mill Valley next to Sausalito up there. It wasn't fancy then. And so all these movie stars came, and they had trailers all over our high school. And I didn't recognize that era at all. That wasn't my era. My era was the young hippies smoking pot and, you know, hanging out. So.
And then after, when did you come to Hollywood? But they say somebody goes to Hollywood. By yourself?
I came by myself. I the night before, I had some friends in LA. And so the night before, my mom wished she could have kept me till I was 19. I was 18. We drank a bunch of tequila. I took $50 of my clothes. And I moved down to LA, and I paid room and board at the Ortez's. The Ortez's, all the Latino people took care of me, not the white people.
Oh.
The Ortez's took care of me, the Orbios took care of me, you know. So I was lucky. Yeah, I had a job. I was a waitress. Took about 3 months, and I said, "Well, that was fun, but I'm not doing that anymore." Yeah, I got a job, so
that was. Go ahead.
How long was it till after you moved to Los Angeles that you started working actually after moving to Los Angeles?
Well, you have to be really naive. So I made, you know, my goal. You know, in 3 months I wanted to work, and in 1 year I wanted to do a major part in a film. And in those days that was little possible. And so I did a part in Emergency.
Of course, Johnny Gage.
Yeah.
Gage, yeah.
And I walked over barefoot for the meeting at Universal.
Wow.
It was a hot day. And then I did Lifeguard, you know, with Dan Petrie and Sam Elliott and Ann Archer.
One of my favorite movies.
Within a year. Yeah, I had a great time. I swam in the ocean all day.
That's a great.
The perfect job.
Well done.
That's pretty amazing, isn't it? I mean, you come down with $50, you're hung over from hanging out with your mom drinking tequila, and then the Mexicans take care of you, and then you meet Sam Elliott and Ann Archer, and you're in Lifeguard swimming in the ocean doing a movie.
Yeah, you go, how did this happen? How did this happen?
Oh, that's right. Great. That is fantastic.
Did you ever by chance ever go to the Whiskey or the Roxy and see Edward James Olmos as the house band at the place where when you were the house band, you were destined for stardom? Eddie, tell everybody who were the house bands, and when you became the house band at Gazzari's or the Whiskey, you were destined for stardom.
You know, that was an era that I'm so grateful that I had a chance to exist and understand. I started playing rock and roll in the garage, you know, like most rock and rollers do, garage bands. And I was 14 years old, and we got our first break by playing for like 15 minutes on a weekend at the with the Preston Epps at Pandora's Box.
Oh, wow. That
Pandora's Box was right in the little kind of island.
Cahuenga
and
Franklin.
No. It's the on Sunset Boulevard.
Right.
Okay. As you're coming over Laurel Canyon, it becomes Crescent Heights.
Right.
There's like that little island. That's where there's a little house. And we started playing there, and that was a lot of fun with the Preston Epps. They would play, and then we'd play for like 10, 15 minutes. We were terrible. But, you know, rock and roll in those days was a little bit different. It was a little more innocent. And, you know, as long as you could play three chords, you could get through it. And I screamed. That's all I ever did. But it was good. And it was fun. And then I went over and started playing at Gazzari's on the Sunset Strip. And we started playing there for free. And we followed in Redbone.
Oh, wow.
Okay, Redbone was playing
there. Wow, man.
They played there for 9 straight months. And before them, it was Jim Morrison and the Doors that had been on that stage playing there for months and months and months. That's where they got their start. And then they moved over to the Whiskey, and then they went on to Pacific Ocean Park, POP, and then became the Doors, and they went screaming out. And same with Redbone. Redbone at that time was Pat and Lolly Vegas. They weren't known as Redbone. And but then they went off, and then we took over the stage. And Pat, when he left, he says, "You got to keep the stage for at least 9 months to beat our record, dude." I said, "Okay, I would love to be able to do that, man. If they'll give me a job here for 9 months, I'd be so happy." I spent 4 years, 7 nights a week.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Held the record until we handed it over to Van Halen.
Oh.
Van Halen took it for 4 years and 1 week.
Wow. Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Oh.
They broke everybody's record, and it was wonderful. But that's, you know, I got started in rock and roll, and I was a terrible rock and roll singer. I sing flat, but when you're singing rock and roll, like I said before, you're singing on a PA system. They usually weren't really great. So you kind of like could hear the voice, but you really couldn't tone it down as to being, you know, it wasn't a studio recording in a studio. So, and I screamed and I danced. I was an entertainer. That's what I was. I was an entertainer, period. And so my entertainment got me into, when I went to college, when I was 17 years old, I took an acting class. I'm the only, I think the only actor so far that's come out of East Los Angeles Community College and has been successful.
Wow.
Congratulations.
Yeah, it's a really a tremendous understanding. But I went there and I started working as an actor in, along with my music, because I was doing going to school during the day, doing that stuff. Then night I'd be playing at the Gazaris on the Strip. So from 64 to 68, that's what I did. And then in 68, I moved to the Factory, which I don't know. Did you ever, Kathleen, did you ever get a chance to see that place?
No.
You were too young. You wouldn't have seen that. It was 1968. It was owned by Paul Newman. You know.
Where was it on, it on was Sunset as well?
No. It was on Lapeer between Santa Monica and Melrose. There's a little street called Lapeer. And it was an old factory building. And they never touched the outside. And they would drive a car up, you know, the Lamborghinis and all these expensive cars would drive up. And a guy would run out of a little door. It didn't even have a big door or anything. It had a little door with a light bulb that was hanging by the cord, just hanging there like that. He'd run out, jump in the car. The people would rush into the car, into the place, and the car would take off. And you wouldn't see it. There was no there was a huge parking lot that was full of dirt, but they never used it. And so no one knew that this place was happening. They had tinted the windows black, so you couldn't see inside and you couldn't see light coming out. And you'd ride up an old storage elevator. You'd go up in an old storage elevator, you know, really creepy and ugly and dirty, felt dirty just getting into it. And you'd go up, and as you're going up to this next floor, you'd start to see the unbelievable crystal chandeliers and the unbelievable wealth. This was one of the most exclusive nightclubs in the world at that time. And I performed there for 2 years straight. And I performed I performed for Judy Garland, for for the Stones, the Beatles, you know, all of these great, great performers would come there, because it cost you a lot of money to be able to get in. You had to really pay a lot of money to be a member. I mean, a lot of money. So people who were there were very, very wealthy. And we played there for a few years. And I was honestly, by using music and movement and theater, when I got Zoot Suit, the play, which was all of those things, it was music, it was theater, it was, you know, dancing and singing. And it was all of those things put together. Like they say, I was lucky. And lucky to me is when you're prepared for the opportunity. That's luck.
Okay, so you have a musical background.
Yeah.
You were also very athletic. You were quite a baseball player.
Yeah, I was.
And then you were an actor.
Yeah.
Now you could, you know, we could be honest, or you could tell me what I think you want me to tell. But if of those three, which would you have done at that particular time? Because I know you love music and I know you love baseball and then acting, but what would, I mean, it's all giving you joy. You're very good at what you've done. I mean,
you know, you get to the point where you just are fortunate that you were given the opportunity to understand it. And I understood it. I really did. I helped produce my music, my records. I helped write my music. Then I went on to produce theater and write plays and work in off LA theater, which is really far off of Broadway.
Right.
And then went on to excel to the point of where I went on Broadway. I got into Broadway in 1978. The very first major piece of work that has ever been on the Latino culture in the history of theater. And it was on Broadway, and I won the Tony nomination. And it was an amazing experience doing El Pachuco. But of all of those, I mean, I was playing baseball at the age of 13 and 14. I was catching like Eddie Roebuck, and I was playing in the single A ball. And it was the winter league for pros. That's where I was playing already. And I was a little kid. I wasn't really built at all. I wasn't, but the thing was, is that they were grooming me, and they saw that I was there, and that I knew how to play the game, and I played it very, very well. And I was a very good hitter. In my league, I won the California Golden State champ batting championship for 2 years in a row. I was batting over 400, you know, amazing. It was like amazing. I mean, like, whoa. So everybody thought I was going to be a ball player, and so did my dad. And then I heard rock and roll. 1956, 57, man, rock and roll started coming. And by 1960, I was, whoa, man, I started singing with my next door neighbor who played guitar. He played guitar. This before the Stones, this before the Beatles, before any of those. We were listening to, you know, Ritchie Valens and Buddy Holly, and we were listening to, you know, Little Richard, all of those players, you know, and playing our little music and stuff in the garage. And that's how music got involved. And I stopped playing baseball. And everybody freaked out. My father freaked out. Everybody. I mean, you know, I was playing with Bobby Knopp and Gary Knopp. The Knopp brothers were playing. Bobby Knopp went off to become the manager or the coach of the Angels for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And you know, with George Pena and all these great, great, you know, Rick Fenton was the one who was carrying me and teaching me how to play. Him and Tony Parra. And they brought me through. And when I stopped, they really got hurt. They all got hurt. And that really was a big change. Hey, man, I want to sing in rock and roll. Oh, my God, are you kidding? You're a ball player. What's wrong with you? And so I got in with the discipline, determination, and perseverance and patience that I had learned playing baseball. Because I couldn't play baseball when I started. I couldn't even catch a ball. But I disciplined myself to do the things I love to do when I didn't feel like doing them. And I did it 7 days a week, like musicians play music. They do it 7 days a week. You don't mess around. You do it every day. You know, people say, you can't do something every day. I say, how many of you brush your teeth every day? You brush them every day. You don't even like it, but you do it anyway. So that being said, I used that, which I'd learned, the discipline, determination, perseverance, and patience. And I just got into music and used the same thing. And I did 7 days a week. And pretty soon I was really the best that I could be, not better than anybody else. I wasn't better than anybody else. I was lucky that I was able to just feel comfortable standing up on the stage. That's why I took acting classes to learn how to be a performer up on stage and singing rock and roll. And then when Zoot Suit came along, man, it just shot right through the roof. And I'm not kidding you. From Zoot Suit on out, I had total creative control of my character from that moment on. To this moment, to this day,
right.
I control the characters that I perform in. And that was the biggest change of my life. Now, you asked me which one of the three, I watch baseball every day. I watch every game the Dodgers play, man. I watch every single, I missed one game during the preseason. And, you know, tonight I'm waiting to, we're going to win tonight, the A's. And, you know, so we'll see. Anyway. Well, you and I and Kathleen,
but that's an interesting
time.
We had a great time watching the Dodgers.
You're a great athlete, okay? George, people don't even know it. You're a great athlete, not a good one, a great one. You yourself say, oh, come on, Eddie. No,
as you get older, you start to realize that you weren't as talented. I never did well with women. Like I can understand that because if they're not around you, it's easy to tell. That you're not very good.
Hey, and look at mine. They're all over me.
You know, and I think that's part of the bravado of like, oh yeah, you know, she's lucky. You know, yeah, they were lucky. I left them alone. But as I got older, I started to realize. Like, I remember one time I made a big deal when I was 15 because I didn't make it to the All-Star team, and I thought I should have. And then now I realize I sucked. I was like just being this pain in the ass kid. Like, hey, how come I didn't make it? I was awful. So in hindsight, you look back in hindsight and you go, okay, I mean, some athletic ability, but not as much as I thought. I think I had enough that God had given me enough athletic ability to make friends that I was going to end up keeping a long time because of baseball. A lot of those guys I'm still friends with 40 years later. And I think taking them to the games and all that stuff is a really nice thing because you grow up, you know, when you're in high school, all five guys in the car and you're going to the games and all this stuff. And then later on, you're able to take those guys on the field and meet some of the players is really nice. You know, yeah. I still was very affected by all of that, like meeting your heroes. Who did you meet, Kathleen, when you came to Hollywood that you thought, wow, that's so-and-so? Anybody? I mean, I'm sure you.
No, it wasn't. Let me think. It wasn't so much. I wasn't very celebrity in awe of, sort of. But I do remember I met Olivia de Havilland.
Woo!
Wow.
And I went, wow. Now there's a real woman, a real lady. And she was very exciting. I got more excited when I met Captain James Lovell.
Oh, wow.
You know, headed up the actual Apollo 13 mission. To me, that was like, and then when I met, oh my God, you're going to kill me. I'll think of them. But so that was very exciting. And I also remember when I was frustrated early on as an actor, you know, because I wasn't used to not working consistently. And I wrote a letter to Jacques Cousteau.
Oof.
Oh. And I said, I'll work in the kitchen. I'll do whatever you want. Just can I come work for you? I didn't get an answer. But
wow. Was there ever a time, though? I mean, you had a great acting career, of course. Was there ever a time that you regretted leaving marine biology behind?
No, not so much. Yeah, not really marine biology so much because, sadly, I see what we do to the ocean. Mm. And I knew it was going to be really painful to watch, and it is. But I did, it was hard to leave athletics. Athletics is my number one. That's what I love the most. But in those days, you could not do anything like a commercial or any kind of promotion. You would lose your amateur status and then you couldn't compete. Mm-hmm. But I can't make any money doing this, you know?
Yeah.
So I decided I'd just keep it as my first love and, you know.
Well, I gotta tell you, Kathleen, you're gonna really just like, I'll go nuts. During Miami Vice in Miami in 1984, when we started there, Jacques Cousteau would park the Calypso in Miami to get it serviced. And he would invite me over.
We
used to have lunch and dinner there, and they would be working on their boats and stuff, and, you know, cleaning it and everything.
Right.
And I would bring, I brought HBO, I think. No, what was it? Some kind of a signal for them to be able to watch cable.
And the Calypso.
Yeah, it was beautiful, man.
What was Jacques Cousteau like?
Beautiful man.
Camera. Great
beautiful
guy.
Man. But his son was amazing, too.
They all were.
Philippe, great family. Right? Yeah, Philippe passed, yeah. But, you know, it's very difficult, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, when I remember Jacques Cousteau, did he used to send Philippe on all the shit that was too tough for him to do? Like, Philippe is going to go to the bottom of the ocean with no apparatus. He's going to hold his breath. He's going to go down and release air on the way up. Yep. I was like, how come? Hey, tell it. It's like any father. Philippe, go down there.
Right? Jacques had the iron lungs, and Philippe had just a snorkel, and he had to go down there and deal with it.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
It's, you know, he was a, you know, quite an experienced. Jacques was an experienced.
I think that would have made Kathleen very happy to spend her time on the Calypso, diving and just all of the things that he found and all the things that he was about.
Right.
Great.
I'm going to do a film with Chris McDonald, and he's going to play a captain, and I'm going to be a dock rat. I call him dock rats, but I work on the dock filling up people's boats kind of thing. So typecasting will be fun.
Do you need somebody to clean the bottom of the boats?
No, I can do that. Mask? Thank you.
What brought us all to walking with Herb?
Woo.
I know it's not our faith. It's been very well received, by the way.
Has it
by
really?
People. Yes, absolutely. The reviews are very good, and people are excited about the film coming out, and especially after this year. You know, we could talk about what's faith-based, because I said every movie would be faith-based, because it's always you start someplace and you wind up in a better place in the end. And, or if you don't, it's still a journey. And along that journey, something has to be tested, and it's usually someone's faith that's tested.
You know, I got to say that you asked the question, what got us involved? What got me involved was that I got a phone call from Ross, the director, producer, son-in-law of Mark Medoff, the great, writer and storyteller. And he says, Mark has written a script for you, for you. I took a deep breath. I said, whoa, that's a strange call to get. I never have had a call like that. In all my years of doing this work, have I ever had anybody call up and say, we wrote this for you. You know, well, okay. So
can I stop you? I think Ross is like that though. I think if Ross went to McDonald's and somebody helped him, the manager, he'd say, listen, we wrote this script for you. He's like, I'm a manager of McDonald's.
Oh my gosh.
I think that's Ross's
forte.
You know what? I even hate to say this because it's Ross. But I think that's his move. You know how these dudes have moves, man. I think. But I get it. But I think, you know, Ross is. Well, that's a way of making you feel like you're the only actor in the world.
Did you go fishing, man? You know, I got hooked. I got hooked by the name Mark Medoff. I got hooked.
That's true.
That caught me, and I said, I didn't give a shit what he was saying, how he was saying it. I did, like I said, Zoot Suit, and we did Zoot Suit right at the same time that they were doing Children of a Lesser God at the Mark Taper Forum, and so I had met him, and super intellectual, super energetic, and very, very disciplined. I mean, very kind of never smiled. I didn't see him. Hey, how you doing? No, he's always right. Really him and Gordon Davidson. So when they told me that he had wanted me to read his script, I said, great, send it to me. You know, I didn't freak out and say, oh my God. No, but I said, okay, send it to me. I'd like to read it. So I read it. And man, it was like War and Peace. You know, it was like this long script with so many words. I mean, it was just really written. All of it worked. It all worked. But it was just, there was soliloquies in there that would, you know, they would rival Shakespeare, you know, because it was so intellectually profound in the way he wrote. And so... anyway, I read it and I said, you know, I told Ross that, you know, that the script had to be worked on, you know, that it was a brilliant story, but it was just not a movie. It was written like a movie, but it wasn't a movie. It was almost like a play.
True.
You know, just a long, beautiful, I mean, you could see the scenes lasting forever, like you're doing a play. So anyway, that's what got me started there. It was a story, one, written by Mark Medoff, and that the rest was history.
We sat and did the table read, and Eddie says, I got to be out of here at 7 p.m. I go, it's 1:30. We'll be out here by 7. We started at 2 o'clock, and by 7, Eddie's like, I'm leaving. We weren't done reading the script 5 hours later. And Eddie's like, listen, I'm sorry, man, but I got to go. There's still like 30 pages. I got to go. And then he looks at me before he leaves and goes, half of this shit's not going to be in there if we do this. Because it was so much, like there's no way that we could ever have shot all of that.
We shot a lot of it. We ended up editing a lot of it. You know, I helped edit it. And we edited a lot of our stuff down. You saw it. You know what we did and what we didn't make it. The screen, because right. And I often told him, I said, you got to put the camera where the story is, and you got to have the story moving itself. Don't pontificate on on Mark's words. You know, let the story emerge through the actors, and the silent moments are the best. And that's what made, you know, Kathleen just like scream. She stole the show. I mean, we're out here talking and all this, and she's standing there. Just looking.
Wonderful.
Kathleen goes, get out of here. You just no, it's true. Again, look at the movie. And you look at the movie, Kathleen, and you tell me the silent moments. Okay.
you guys have a wonderful relationship. And then you and Kathleen had done something before together, right? A movie that you directed, I think, Eddie.
Yeah, we did.
Eddie directed The Devil Has a Name.
Name, yeah. And I asked Kathleen to come and help me, and she did. I was very grateful for that one, too. It was really, it's a wonderful story. And it's good. It was a good time. We had a great time. And then when I asked her to come and join us to do this one, she goes, come over to my house. sit down outside. I want to read the script, but I don't want to read it without you being there. I want to read it with you. I go, okay, we'll read it together.
That's great.
So we
great.
Did. Yeah.
Well, I know you had worked with Kathleen before, and you had known George before, but you had never worked with him, right, before this. So a lot of times, like when you know somebody, I'm guessing when you work with them, your relationship has an opportunity to change a little bit. Did you feel like it did or didn't, or was it just like working with your buddy on the film?
Now, this became a love affair on all levels. Everything that I'd ever dreamed about, it was the ultimate moment I've had in making a film. First of all, the story was a really sweet story. I mean, people, I guess, I don't know what I've been isolated, so I don't really know everything that maybe George knows, but I'm glad that the people are liking it, you know? And as far as it being a faith-based, yeah, it's got faith in it, yes. And it's got a sense of, second chance. That's really what the movie's about. It's about second chances. Mm-hmm. And us being able to have the faith in ourselves, not in God and somebody. Yeah, it's about having faith in oneself that makes you live and try to understand yourself to the fullest. So that theme is magnificent. And then working with Kathleen and George, like a blessing.
You know, Kathleen, when you and Eddie as a couple in the movie starts, and you know he's not, you know, you as a family have suffered loss, but in a relationship, if one person like this, you know, you kept your faith and you kept your the family up, but in a relationship, if someone can't see because of the pain, I think that might bring both people down, that the pain is stronger than somebody's belief in someone else.
Yeah, right. That's
and in
right.
this, you didn't give up on him, and you saw him smile, and you saw him start to rebuild himself.
Well, I would say that Sheila didn't give up on him, because Sheila was a different person than me. She has more faith. She's a little purer. She's has a little more strength in that department than
Sheila
I do.
Is.
Yeah,
yes.
So it was fun to explore that. And just to backtrack a little, when Eddie actually came out to the house with Alex, and he asked me if I would do it after we were kind of done playing around with some of the scenes. And I said yes, because it's Edward James Olmos. What am I going to do, say no? I mean, it was lucky for me to be able to work with him and to work with Mark Medoff. I'd worked with Mark before. So it just seemed a little too fortuitous, and I had to take the leap. So.
And was there a favorite part when you're going over the script together? Was there a something when you were reading the script that clicked and made you say, yeah, I'm in? Or was it just working with the people you're working with?
Yeah, there's this really kind of, could have been this really cheesy moment in the script. And I decided to kind of cut against it and just talk to him like I would talk to him. Mm-hmm. And he was, you could do that, or you could say that God's saying this. And Eddie was, he's an actor who's just right there. Like you're not gonna throw him any sliders that he's not gonna see. You know what I mean? So there's a safety there, and there's a freedom as an actor, and that doesn't always happen. I've worked with two other, I won't say who, leading men, where they say, okay, you're up tomorrow, and you're supposed to act like you've been married for 30 years, and go. I said, wait a minute. I don't even know what this guy likes to eat for dinner. How am I going to act like I've known him for 30 years? So I have had to request just a lunch or just a meeting, just a something where I can kind of see if I can find a connection, because I don't like that playing the wife thing. You know, right. If there is something really going on there, I'm not interested. Yeah.
How about you, George?
I think that's very true. Well, it is the largest bit of acting that I had done. And interestingly enough, I wasn't afraid of it. You know, when I did that movie about the robotics team, and I wanted to produce it, but I didn't want to be in it. And then they said that they wouldn't do it unless I was in it. And it was a lot. These guys were younger guys. And in the beginning, they were acting like younger guys. And then I had to do something that wasn't really, you know, good for all of us. I had to say, listen, man, I don't give a fuck what you guys do when you're away. But singing songs in between takes and playing trivia in between takes is not, we can't do that. Like, we have to take this work, we have to take serious. And they really weren't there. And I did that early enough that it got them there. And because I was like, I'm not going to sit here while you guys are playing Frank Sinatra trivia and expect our performances to be worth seeing. But this one was different. And I rehearsed on some, but not the way Eddie wanted to rehearse this. And I wasn't into going every day, all day for a month, just because of my own, as a stand-up, you don't have to do that. In TV, you don't have to do that. But this was a real film, and it could not have worked any other way, because whatever insecurities I had or whatever thinking that this was a huge part and I had to play this guy Herb that was all of these different things, being with Eddie all those days and then meeting you and then us reading it and then us all getting along really well protected me from, I would say, my instincts were good, protected me from talking myself out of a good performance. I was prepared, where usually I would have maybe not have dug as deep, but the fact that you made me do that, I don't think I'll work any other way now going forward, that really got us together and made us stay together. And I think that's why the ending is so emotional, because, you know, meeting him in 1988 and then doing this and then us all becoming in love with each other. And then he says, is this it? I think Herb knows that he's probably going on somewhere else. His mission was accomplished. Mm-hmm. He finally was able to pass through. So when he says, is this it? And then our moment there with the tear and then our moment together was just really almost a graduation from stand-up to TV guy to being in a movie with the writer and the actors, all of Academy Award nominee and caliber. So... and I'm glad it was toward the end, because I needed to earn all of those things. I remember Kathleen coming in going, hey, the police want to talk to you. And I wasn't, you know, shocked. I was like, yeah, where are they? And she's like, came in and I said, what's up? And she hadn't come in my trailer. You know, the police, they're on to you. Like, what? Where are they? She came in to warn me. The police are here. They want to talk to you.
But you really delivered. You delivered. I mean, that's a pretty ballsy part to take on. I mean,
you know, I said it in some of the interviews that I've done nationally on national stuff, that and I told him, I said, please don't tell him, but I'm going to tell you right now, you're a great athlete. And what I mean by that is that you really commit yourself to when you, whatever you're mm-hmm. doing in form of athleticism. And you shoot, you can see that in your golf. Your golf game is really good. You're as mm-hmm. good as the pros. You could have been a pro if you wanted to. And you chose to continue to use it, but you know, you play it so well. Well, when you were done with this movie, George, you're a better actor than you are a golfer. And you're a hell of a golfer, George. And I was so happy because it was hard for me. It was hard for me to say, okay, George is going to try to do this, and I hope that George doesn't bring George. Because if George comes, then George is going to be playing Herb. And that is not Herb. We need Herb. We don't need George. We need Herb. And so, and he did it. I remember rehearsing, and when we started rehearsal, yeah, he did. And when we started rehearsals in this room, you know, and my assistant would be reading all the other parts, and we'd be reading the story. And then, you know, Ross was there, and it was just Ross, my assistant, and George and myself. And we'd be standing there going through the pieces. All of a sudden, like about the second or third time we did this one scene, it locked in such a way that I looked at him and I said, you son of a bitch. You did it, man. I remember telling you that. Do you remember when I said that? I said, you know, this is amazing, George. I'm very, very excited. I can't tell you, man. You just went through the roof, man. And that's one of the great things, because people are going to, they're going to laugh. We're fun. We stay fun. We're still up and going around. we have a great time. But the truth of the situation was so pure and so beautiful. That's what happened with Kathleen and me. We hit it, and boy, we went there and we loved each other. And it was just gorgeous, gorgeous moments of understanding with umpteenth years of being together. I mean, you could feel how much we loved each other and how much we could play with each other and how much, you know, we cared about each other. And through the, look at, the only thing I could ever say to anybody that's listening to this right now is may you bury your parents, and may your children bury you, and may their children bury them, and may that chain never be broken, because if it's broken, you're going to not live a life that you thought you were going to live. I don't care how good you are as a person. You're ruined. Your life is completely off kilter. And that's what the story starts off with. People don't know what the story is, but I got to tell you, it starts, I'll give you the beginning, and that'll be the only time I'm really going to make it, you know, possible for you to understand something, because basically when we start this movie off, we start off with the burying of, you know, Sheila, Kathleen, my wife, and myself, and my daughter, Jessica Medoff, who's Mark Medoff's daughter, and she played Audrey Amabiliamo, and we're standing at a funeral for our three-year-old granddaughter, my granddaughter, her daughter, and I am over. No more. I am done. I don't want to hear none of this shit that they're saying at the funeral site. I can't take it. And I've lost all my faith. And of course, Sheila is just holding on, man, and just saying, come on, man, cut it out. Stop it. And my daughter saying, keep the faith. And I said, I have no faith. What are you talking about? Faith. You know, we're burying my granddaughter next to her father, who was a doctor who got killed in the war as a doctor before the baby was born. You know, and no, I take that back. He was alive. He did get to see the baby. He was alive. Mm-hmm. We have photographs of him and the baby. And he ends up dying. And then we're burying the baby. There's a coffin. Man. Ah, that's how the movie starts. And what happens? Up rides Herb. And I don't see him. He sees us, but we don't see him. Upright Herb, and Herb looks unbelievably weird. And he's
I will tell you this. The amount of takes that pastor needed to take and she was reading it out of her book. I thought that was going to be four dead bodies, me, you, and Kathleen, and the little one right there. You're just like, is this? And then we went to the church and did it. You're like, are we all, she can read it out of the, oh. Remember we all were looking at each other like, you know, we're standing there, you know, very peaceful. I'm all in white. I'm looking at you guys. You're like.
Yeah. No. Bob Lambert took care of that.
Yeah.
Bob and Lambert's amazing.
Yeah.
Beautiful job, Bob.
Bob Lambert's amazing. Great editor.
Great editor.
And you know, in these things, you know, I remember I've said it on this thing before, like, I used to look at my grandmother when I was a teenager, and my grandfather wasn't biological. My grandmother was. And I would look at her and think, if anything happened to this woman with me still growing up, becoming a man, I don't think that I would have survived losing my grandmother. I know I wouldn't have. Yeah. And fortunately she didn't pass when I was a young teenager, but I wasn't surrounded by people that would have made me feel better with that loss. So thankfully, I never had to experience that, even though she wasn't particularly kind to me, but that was just a result of her own life. You can't, you know, teach somebody. But thankfully that when people, you know, suffer loss, that we have to keep going for the people that are around us. But I think it's the hardest thing to ever do. When you get older and all your friends go, like Brian, this dude is the fucking Grim Reaper. Everybody that guy comes in contact with passes.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Sorry, guys. That's why we did this on Zoom. We did this on Zoom today for a reason.
Right, Brian. Like a lot of my friends, what do you think that is?
I don't know.
You guys all live near Dow Corning or fucking right on the cul-de-sac?
I don't know. I lost a couple of my very good friends, best friends from high school in their 50s. And then my wife, just, I mean, it's every year it's been a lot of people. So it's one of those things where you appreciate. But my question to you is that it's a faith-based movie. And you're professional actors. You've been doing it for many, many years. But is there something that you take from a movie like doing this for months on end? Do you take some of that with you? Do you feel a little bit more faithful when you leave the set off the last day, or is it just kind of like you just live your life? Because I know you're on your own person, but does some of that ever sink in? Because Kathleen, your character is very, very faithful in the movie.
Yeah, I didn't take any of that with me. I wish I had.
I think she's a little bit crazier. I think Kathleen's way more than we thought. Like, I think, you know, she's like this, you know.
Oh, that was awesome. That was perfect.
Yeah, but I tell you what I did take from this film. I had more fun on this film than probably any other film that I've done. With these guys, I mean,
you all seem like such a family.
My heart forever.
You're right. I was lucky enough to spend a couple of days on set and be a mouse in the corner, and you guys got along like family. You just literally enjoyed each other's company, which is very, very cool to see.
And it's a big loss when you lose that kind of family. You have to go through a grief period. You know, like I knew George in terms of, you know, being a comedian and everything, but I didn't know the warmth and the sensitivity and the caring, and you know, he's great fun, but I want to know what else is going on there, and that really all of those qualities really lent to his work. So
I'm a little bit dark, but you know, I you know, fell in love with you, and I loved Eddie, and like when I see you right now, you know, I love you. So from coming from the movie and doing that, you know, I've done a lot of movies, but I don't revere the people that I did the movie as much as I hold you in high regard, Kathleen. You're really just a fantastic person and a wonderful actress. And I love you. I feel, you know, we all were together. And I think, listen, it's no secret. Eddie, if you were available, Eddie would be in the Santa Monica Mountains. But you know, it's wonderful that we were able to put Mark's last words that he had written and make them come to life. And although he really, unfortunately, didn't look well, the joy that radiated from this guy's face and his smile and his body when his body was shutting down and he was starting to, what he had written was coming to fruition. Like somebody who had suffered loss, I think he ultimately knew that where he was, because some days he'd show up and some days he wouldn't, but when he was there, to have him look at you with that face of his smile and radiating that love that he, or put his hand on you and you know, watching through the monitor, brilliant.
It's the best. And you know, it's interesting because Ross really made us feel comfortable and free to sort of do what we wanted to do. And so you, consequently, you don't think about him quite as much because he did what most directors are supposed to do. They're supposed to be kind of invisible. And he kind of, you know, you don't think of him as much of a presence as all of us, but he was there, you know. He helped us do whatever we wanted to do.
I think that style of directing, because you know, you both, you know, it's got to be difficult for a director to slide into that, especially with Mark out of vision, but to be in control and yet be invisible and allow you mm-hmm. to make your choices acting and acting, I think is the strength of a director that allow you to do those things.
And boy, was it fun watching you two golf.
I got what about that? But also I was telling Brian that you came out in 30 plus degree weather when you didn't have dialogue and you stood there with us. And I'm not sure many actors would do that.
Oh, I believe in being a good soldier, and I'm Irish, and that's nothing. You get paid for standing there, you know. How tough can it be? All those little kids were freezing. I couldn't stand that part, though.
So. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that brings me to the athletic part, Edward. You have your golf swing looks great in the movie. What? And you had said that you were not an avid golfer. So did it take a little bit of training to get to that point? Because your golf swing looks fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, look, it looks like I haven't swung a golf club in 35 years. And that's what it was supposed to look. It was not supposed to look like the guy had been training and it was a really good golfer. So what happened, which I was lucky, they gave me enough time to hit balls. And when you start to really understand, and I'm a baseball player, so I kind of have that eyeball coordination, but it's a lot different. Hitting a ball that is moving is really, really difficult, especially when it's coming at 100 miles an hour and it's doing all kinds of turns and stuff. It's just like really ridiculous. But you train, you get yourself to the point of where you learn how to read the ball and boom, you can hit it. And you see it happening all the time. But to hit a little ball that's not moving, that's on the ground, mm-hmm. and control it. Oh my God. It's probably one of the most beautiful sports I've ever tried to be understanding of, because I'd played the game, you know, throughout the years I've done a lot of work with the people that put on golf tournaments and we do fundraisers and I go there and I play and everybody, but we always played scramble. Mm-hmm. I never had played an entire game 18 holes with me hitting the ball and getting it in there and going to every hole and doing myself. I never did that. To this day, I've never really done it. Wow. You know, I played somewhat with George, but I got to tell you, when I started to hit the ball and I started to focus and I started to understand the beauty of, it's like ballet. It's like, it's so rhythmic. It's so, it's like music, it's like dance, it's like, it's beautiful. It's like at one with, wow. And you feel it, you can feel the club, you feel the presence of understanding that just like, whoa, man. And it's just like, oh, it's beautiful. So I started doing that. I hit thousands of balls. Oh, thousands.
Wow.
Thousands.
You really did turn into someone that, if they watch the film, you will believe that this person's a golfer. There was a guy that I played with at the AT&T on a Sunday, and he was a roofer who was a good golfer, who went to qualifying school and qualified, and he had a couple of exemptions. One of them was the AT&T. So little did I know that even back in 2004, I was playing with a guy who was so unbelievably overtaken by Pebble Beach as any, as I wouldn't say not a professional golfer would, but by anyone who was able to play there as a golfer, much less as a guy who had qualified, but his eyes were wide open, and we're walking on this Sunday and he just can't believe it. And little did I know that in 2004, I was really kind of playing with the guy that would have become, you know, Joe Mabliamo later on. And he hit thousands of balls. And then tell everybody, Eddie, when Kathleen hit a golf ball, how well she hit it on once.
On camera. On camera. I got to tell you, that was the beauty of what you talk about, having faith, and you had to talk about having been touched by the hand of God. Kathleen, we had a scene to do. And the scene was that I'd put the ball down and she would start off by swinging the club, hitting the ball and watching go. And, you know, she's athletic, very athletic. And I don't know if she's swung the golf club. She's been golfing. She knew how to golf. But I don't know how long it had been. How long had it been since she swung a club and hit the ball?
Can you probably know? 10 years.
Oh, 10 my. Years. Yeah. And the very first shot, the very first take, the very first moment, she stands there and we're laughing and just, it's just beautiful, beautiful feeling between us. And I mean, everything just feels so real, so honest, so pure. And she just stands up and goes, oh boy, whack, whoa, straight out, man, a beautifully hit ball. And we looked at each other and started laughing. She ran into my arms and we hugged each other and it was all facts, man. It was,
that was the one time I really did pray. Please God, don't let me F up in front of these guys. I want to hit this ball.
It's hard to do, man, if you've never played the game. And don't take it so lightly when you see it being played and you see these guys doing what they do with the little ball and how they control it. It's
easy.
Unbelievably difficult. Yeah. It's one of the most difficult games in the world, I think.
You know, I think it's quite a world, man, that brought us all together. You know, my journey with Edward of, you know, of seeing him. I saw him in Zoot Suit in high school, and I'd never seen, I'd never seen a play, but then to see that play and to see that guy, the Pachuco, mm-hmm. was just eye-opening, man, for a young Chicano kid. And, you know, following you, kind of seeing you and seeing in your films, and to end up all together and to end up like this, you know, it's been a year and a half since we did it. And if you look at us, it would look like we've been, you know, together since then. But, you know, walking with her, is I think people will understand it. I don't think there's been a time that we need a movie like this more than this past year.
Yeah.
Especially with so much division within this country, that if there's one thing that would bond us, it would be our faith.
Yeah. I totally agree.
So.
Yeah.
You would hope so.
I hope so. I mean, I'm not a religious person. I think it's all very interesting, all the stories and the fables of the different religions. But I just go, so one person calls it Buddha, so one person calls it Yahweh, one person calls it whatever. What difference does it make? You know, and people are different colors, so what? I mean, if you believe in God, you think he made a mistake? I mean,
well,
I don't
get it. Yeah.
Well, I think he may have made one mistake. Brian, show that nose again.
He's overcommitted on this one a little bit. Outside of that, we're all right.
Well, thank you guys for spending this time with us right here. Brian,
it was
oh, my God, Ed.
Brian, oh, my God. Oh, my God. I got nervous when I met you.
And thanks for hanging out with us backstage in Portland. That was very nice as well. And Edward, what a pleasure. What a pleasure to have you on. Thank you guys so much.
Oh, Brian, please. Thank you.
I love you both.
Love you guys.
Go Dodgers.
Go Dodgers.
Go Dodgers.
All right, guys. Thank you, Kathleen. All right, Eddie. Bye. Thank you, guys.
Bye.